The sky rained dismal. It rained humdrum. It rained a tattoo on the old hamburger boxes and chip papers in the wire basket that was giving Masklin a temporary hiding place. Look at him. Wet, cold, worried, and 4 inches high. The waste bin was usually a good hunting ground, even in winter. There were often a few cold chips in their wrappings, sometimes even a chicken bone. Once or twice, there'd been a rat, too. It had been a really good day when there'd last been a rat. It had kept them going for a week. Masklin scanned the lorry park. And here it came again, right on time, crashing through the puddles and pulling up with a hiss of brakes. He'd watched this lorry arrive every Tuesday and Thursday morning for the last 4 weeks. He timed the driver's stop carefully. They had exactly 3 minutes. To someone the size of a gnome, that's more than half an hour. It's all a sort of relativity. The faster you live, the more time stretches out. To a gnome, a year lasts as long as 10 years does to a human. He scrambled down through the greasy paper, dropped out of the bottom of the bin, and ran for the bushes at the edge of the park where Grimmer and the old folk were waiting. "It's here," he said. "Come on." But they were too slow. He turned to Grimmer. "Come on! Give them a prod or something. They'll never get moving." She patted his hand. "They're frightened. You go on. I'll bring them out." Masklin ran back, unslinging the rope and grapnel. It had taken him a week to make the hook out of a bit of wire teased off a fence, and he'd spent days practicing. He was already swinging it around his head as he reached the lorry's wheel. The hook caught the tarpaulin high above him at the second try. He tested it once or twice, and then, his feet scrabbling for a grip on the tyre, pulled himself up. He scrambled under the heavy tarpaulin and into the darkness beyond, pulling out more line and tying it as tightly as possible around one of the ropes that were as thick as his arm. Then he slid back to the edge, and thank goodness Grimmer was herding the old people across the gravel. It seemed to take hours. Old Granny Morky insisted that all the men look the other way so that they wouldn't see up her skirts, for example. And old Torrit whimpered so much that Masklin had to lower him again so that Grimmer could blindfold him. It wasn't so bad after he'd hauled the first few up, because they were able to help on the rope, but time still stretched out. He pulled Grimmer up last. She was light. They were all light if it came to that. He didn't get rat every day. "Right," he said. "That's it, then. Now, if we just go..."
"I dropped the thing," said old Torrit. "The thing. I dropped it, you see? I dropped it down by the wheel when she was blindfolding me."
Masklin looked at him in horror. Then he poked his head out from under the tarpaulin, and yes, there it was, far below, a tiny black cube on the ground. The thing. And then he heard the sound of slow footsteps on the gravel. "There's no time. There really is no time. We can't go without it," said Grimmer. "Of course we can. It's just a thing. We won't need the wretched object where we're going." Granny Morky drew herself up to her full, quivering height.
"May you be forgiven. What a terrible thing to say, you tell him, Torrit. If we ain't taking the thing..."
"I ain't going," said Torrit.
"It's not that your leader talking to you," interrupted Granny Morky. "So you go and get it this minute."
Masklin threw the line over the edge and slid down it. He reached out and scooped up the thing, and the lorry started to move. First there was a roar, then there was a blast of stinking air and a vibration that shook the ground. He pulled sharply on the line and yelled at them to pull him up, and just as the big wheel began to turn, the rope tightened. He bounced and spun back and forth as with painful slowness they pulled him past the wheel. Hands reached down and caught him under the arms and dragged him into the booming space under the tarpaulin. Behind the speeding lorry, fresh curtains of grey rain dragged across the empty fields. And across the whole country, there were no more gnomes. There had been plenty of them in the days when it didn't seem to rain so much. Masklin could remember at least 40. But then the motorway had come. The stream was put in pipes underground, and the nearest hedges were grubbed up. Gnomes had always lived in the corners of the world, and suddenly there weren't too many corners anymore. The numbers started going down. A lot of this was due to natural causes, and when you're 4 inches high, natural causes can be anything with teeth and speed and hunger. Then the cafe had been built a little further along the road. It had been a sort of improvement. It depended how you looked at cold leftover chips and scraps of grey chicken. And then it was spring, and Masklin looked around and found that there were just 10 of them left, and 8 of those were too old to get about much. Old Torrit was nearly 10. It had been a dreadful summer. Grimmer organised those who could still get about into midnight raids on the litter bins, and Masklin tried to hunt. Hunting by yourself was like dying a bit at a time. Most of the things you were hunting were also hunting you. To get enough to eat, you needed lots of healthy hunters. But to get lots of healthy hunters, you needed enough to eat. "It'll be all right in the autumn," said Grimmer, bandaging his hand where a stoat had caught it. "There'll be mushrooms and berries and nuts and everything." Well, there hadn't been any mushrooms, and it rained so much that most of the berries rotted before they ripened. And then the back of the burrow fell in because of all the rain. Oh, and there was the fire. You needed a fire at the burrow mouth, both for cooking and for keeping away night prowlers. Granny Morkey went to sleep one day and let it go out. Even she had the decency to be embarrassed. When Masklin came back that night, he looked at the heap of dead ashes for a long time, and then stuck his spear in the ground and burst out laughing, and went on laughing until he started to cry. He couldn't face the rest of them. He had to go and sit outside, where presently Grimmer brought him a shellful of nettle tea. Cold nettle tea. "I've had enough," he said quietly. "I'm going to leave."
"But we need you."
"I need me too. I mean, what kind of life is this?"
"But they'll die if you go away."
"They'll die anyway," said Masklin.
"That's a wicked thing to say."
"Well, it's true. Everyone dies anyway. We'll die anyway. Look at you. You spend your whole time washing and tidying up and cooking and chasing after them."
"Granny Morkey was very kind to me when I was small," said Grimmer defensively. "You'll be old one day."
"You think? And who'll be working their fingers to the bone to look after me?"
Masklin found himself getting angrier and angrier. He was certain he was in the right, but it felt as if he was in the wrong, which made it worse. He'd thought about this for a long time, and it always left him feeling angry and awkward. All the clever ones and the bold ones and the brave ones had gone long ago, one way or the other. "Good old Masklin," they'd said. "Stout chap, you look after the old folk, and we'll be back before you know it, just as soon as we've found a better place." Every time good old Masklin thought about this, he got indignant with them for going and with himself for staying. He always gave in. That was his trouble. He knew it. Whatever he promised himself at the start, he always took the way of least resistance. Grimmer was glaring at him. He shrugged. "All right, all right. So they can come with us," he said. They left it at that. There were nuts for dinner. Masklin's had a maggot in it. He went out afterwards and sat at the top of the bank with his chin in his hands, watching the motorway. It was a stream of red and white lights. There were humans inside those boxes, going about whatever mysterious business humans spend their time on. They were always in a hurry to get to it, whatever it was. Humans had it really easy. They were big and slow, but they didn't have to live in damp burrows waiting for daft old women to let the fire go out. They never had maggots in their tea. They went wherever they wanted and they did whatever they liked. The whole world belonged to them. And all night long they drove up and down in these little lorries with lights on. He dreamt of leaving on a lorry. They often stopped at the cafe. It would be easy, well, fairly easy, to find a way onto one. They were clean and shiny. They had to go somewhere better than this. And after all, what was the alternative? They'd never see winter through here. And setting out across the fields with the bad weather coming on didn't bear thinking about. Of course he'd never do it. You never actually did it in the end. You just dreamt about following those swishing lights. Somebody screamed. Masklin got to his feet and sped silently through the scrubby bushes towards the burrow, where, its head entirely underground and its brush waving excitedly at the stars, was a dog fox. Somewhere inside Masklin's head, the bit of him that was really him,
Old Torrit had a lot to say about this, but was horrified to see him snatch up his spear, which was still in the ground where he'd plunged it, and stab the fox as hard as he could in a hind leg. There was a muffled yelp, and the animal struggled backwards, turning an evil, foaming mask to its tormentor. Masculine felt himself become angry. It welled up inside him like a huge bubble. The spear soared from his hand like a bird, catching the fox in the lip. It screamed and pawed at the wound, and Masculine was running across the dirt, propelled by the engine of his anger, and then jumping and grabbing handfuls of rank red fur and hauling himself up the fox's flank to land astride its neck and drawing his stone knife and stabbing at everything that was wrong with the world. The fox screamed again and leapt away. It breasted the embankment and rushed headlong down it towards the lights of the motorway. The rushing of the traffic filled Masculine's ears. He let go and threw himself into the long grass as the creature galloped out onto the asphalt. He landed heavily, all the breath knocked out of him.
But he remembered what happened next. The fox, as still as a statue in a headlight beam, snarled its defiance as it tried to outstare 10 tons of metal hurtling towards it at 70 miles an hour. There was a bump, a swish, and darkness. Masculine pulled himself to his feet and plodded back towards whatever was left of his home. Grimmer was waiting at the burrow's mouth.
"We didn't know where you'd gone," she said, her voice on the edge of hysteria. "We just heard the noise, and there it was. You should have been here, and it got Mr. Mert and Mrs. Coombe, and it was digging at the..."
She stopped and seemed to sag. "Yes, thank you," said Masculine coldly. "I'm all right, thank you very much."
What happened?"
He ignored her and trooped into the darkness of the burrow and lay down. He could hear the old ones whispering as he sank into a deep, chilly sleep. "I should have been here," he thought. "They depend on me. We're going. All of us." It had seemed a good idea then. It looked a bit different now. Now the gnomes clustered at one end of the great dark space inside the lorry. They were silent. There wasn't any room to be noisy. The roar of the engine filled the air from edge to edge. Grimmer crawled across the trembling floor.
"How long is it going to take to get there?" she said.
"Where?" said Masculine.
"Wherever we're going."
"I don't know."
"They're hungry, you see."
Masculine crawled his way to the group and sat down between Torrit and Granny Morky. Torrit was the leader of the tribe. It stood to reason. He was the oldest gnome. The oldest was always leader. That way there couldn't be any arguments. Not the oldest woman, of course, because everyone knew this was unthinkable. Even Granny Morky was quite firm about that. Masculine sighed.
"Look, I don't know how long..." "Don't you worry about me, boy," said Granny Morky. "This is all rather exciting, isn't it?"
"But I don't even know where we're going," Masculine burst out. "I'm sorry." Torrit was sitting with the thing on his skinny knees.
"We have the thing," he said. "It'll show us the way, it will."
"And where does this way take us?" said Masculine.
"You know that well enough. To the heavens."
"Oh, yes." Masculine glared at the thing. He was pretty certain that it didn't tell old Torrit anything at all. He had pretty good hearing, and he never heard it say anything. It never did anything. It never moved. The only thing it ever did was look black and square. It was good at that.
"Only by following the thing closely in all particulars can we be sure of going to the heavens," said Torrit.
Masculine stood up on the swaying floor and made his way to the tarpaulin. Then he paused to screw up his courage and poked his head under the gap. There was nothing but blurs and lights and strange smells. Then the lorry turned a corner and, without warning, stopped. He found himself looking into a huge lighted space full of lorries, full of humans. There was whistling outside and the distant rumble of human voices. The lights went out. There was a rattling noise by a click then silence. After a while, there was a faint scrabbling around the back of one of the silent lorries. A length of a no thicker than thread dropped down until it touched the oily floor of the garage. A minute went by. Then, lowering itself with great care, hand over hand, a small, stumpy figure shinned down the line and dropped onto the floor. It wasn't entirely human. There was definitely the right number of arms and legs, and the additional bits like eyes and so on were in the usual places. But the figure that was now creeping across the darkened floor in its mouse skins looked like a brick wall on legs. Gnomes are so stocky that a Japanese sumo wrestler would look half-starved by comparison, and the way this one moved suggested that it was considerably tougher than old boots. Masklin was, in fact, terrified out of his life. There was nothing here that he recognised, except for the smell of oil, which he'd come to associate with humans and especially with lorries. Vast cans loomed above him. There were huge pieces of metal. There were other lorries, all of them silent. It was, Masklin decided, a lorry nest. He untensed a bit and prodded about under a bench that towered against one wall like a house. There were drifts of waste paper there, and led by a smell which here was even stronger than oil, he found a whole apple core. He slung it across one shoulder and turned around. There was a rat watching him thoughtfully. It was considerably bigger and sleeker than the things that fought the gnomes for the scraps from the waste bin. It trotted towards him. Masklin felt that he was on firmer ground here. He knew what a rat was, all right, and what to do about one. He dropped the core, brought his spear back slowly and carefully, aimed at a point just between the creature's eyes. A voice said, "Don't! He took a long time to train. Bargains galore! Where did you come from?" The stranger was a gnome. At least, Masklin had to assume so. He was certainly gnome height and moved like a gnome. But his clothes... The basic colour for a practical gnome's clothes is mud. That was common sense, because any gnome who ventures out wearing jolly reds and blues would have a life expectancy of perhaps half an hour before something digestive happened to him. Whereas this gnome looked like a rainbow. He wore brightly coloured clothes of a material so fine it looked like chip wrapping, a belt studded with bits of glass, proper leather boots, and a hat with a feather in it. As he talked, he slapped his leg idly with a leather strap, which, it turned out, was the lead for the rat, which Masklin now noticed had a little red collar. "Well," the gnome snapped, "answer me." "I came off the lorry," said Masklin shortly, eyeing the rat. It went and hid behind its master.
"Are you trying to tell me you came from outside?"
"That's right."
"You mean really outside?"
"I suppose I do."
"What's it like?"
"What?"
"Outside, what's it like?"
"Well, it's sort of big."
"Yes."
"And, there's a lot of it."
"Yes, yes."
"With, you know, things in it."
"Is it true the ceiling is so high you can't see it?"
"Dunno, what's a ceiling?" said Masklin.
"That is,"
said the gnome, pointing up to a gloomy roof of girders and shadows. "Oh, I haven't seen anything like that," said Masklin. "Outside it's blue or grey, with white things floating around in it."
And the walls are such a long way off, and there's a sort of green carpet thing that grows on the ground."
"Dunno," said Masklin, even more mystified. "What's a carpet?"
"Wow."
The gnome got a grip of himself and extended his shaking hand. "My name's Angelo. Angelo de Haberdasheri." "Of course, that won't mean anything to you. And this is Bobo." The rat appeared to grin. Masklin had never heard a rat called anything, except perhaps, if you were driven to it, dinner. "I'm Masklin. Is it all right if the rest of us come down?"
"Gosh, yes. All from outside. My father will never believe it."
The others came stiffly down the line, grumbling.
"Old people, too, said Angelo. And they look just like us, not even pointy heads or anything.
Sauce,
said Granny Morky. Angelo stopped grinning.
Madam,
he said icily, do you know who you're talking to?
Someone who's not too old for a smack bottom, said Granny Morky.
Pointy heads, indeed.
Angelo's mouth opened and shut silently. Then he said,
it's amazing. I mean, Dorcas said that even if there was a possibility of life outside the store, it wouldn't be life as we know it. Please, please, all follow me.
They exchanged glances as Angelo scurried away towards the edge of the lorry nest, but followed him anyway. Torrid appeared to be reaching a conclusion. They waited for it politely.
I reckon, he said at last, I reckon we ought to eat his rat.
You shut up, you, said Granny automatically.
I'm leader, I am. You've got no right talking like that to a leader,
Torrid whined.
Of course you're leader, snapped Granny Morky. Who said you weren't leader? I never said you weren't leader, you're leader.
Right, sniffed Torrid.
And now shut up, said Granny.
Masklin tapped Angelo on the shoulder. Where is this place, he said. Angelo stopped by the wall.
You don't know?
We just thought, well, we just hoped that the lorries went to a good place to be, said Grimmer.
This is the best place to be, said Angelo proudly. This is the store. The store of Arnold Brothers Est 1905.
Angelo had stopped by a hole in the wall.
In here, he said.
Granny Morky sniffed.
That's a rat hole.
It's a disguised entrance, that's all.
Your rat just went through it, said Granny Morky triumphantly. I've got eyes, it's a rat hole.
Angelo gave Grimmer a pleading look and ducked through the hole. She poked her head through after him.
I don't think it's a rat hole, Granny.
And why is that, pray?
Because there's stairs inside. Oh, and dear little lights.
At the top, the stairs went through a more dignified sort of door into...
Even when he was young, Masklin had never seen more than 40 gnomes altogether at once.
There were more than that here, and there was food. It didn't look like anything he recognised, but it had to be food. After all, people were eating it.
A space, about twice as high as he was, stretched away into the distance. Food was stacked in neat piles with aisles between them, and these were thronged with gnomes. Fruit and vegetables were stacked behind trestle tables, with gnomes working industriously on them. There were other things, too, which Masklin couldn't begin to recognise.
What's that thing over there?
It's a salami sausage, said Angelo.
Ever had it before?
Not lately, said Masklin truthfully.
And they're dates, said Angelo, and that's a banana. I expect you've never seen a banana before, have you?
Masklin opened his mouth, but Granny Morky beat him to it.
Bit small, that one, she said, and sniffed. Very puny. Why, the ones we got at home?
She paused and looked at the banana lying on a couple of trestles like a canoe.
Why, we could hardly dig 'em out of the ground.
Well, whatever, Angelo said vaguely.
You may all help yourselves. Tell the gnomes in charge that it's to go on the haberdashery account, will you?
There was a general rush in the direction of the food. Only Masklin stayed where he was.
Where does all the food come from?
Oh, we take it from the humans, said Angelo airily.
They're rather stupid, you know.
And they don't mind.
They think it's rats, snickered Angelo.
We take up rat doodahs with us, at least the food hall families do, he corrected himself. Then the humans just think it's rats. Masklin's brow wrinkled.
Doodahs?
You know, said Angelo.
Droppings.
They fall for that, do they?
They're very stupid, I told you.
The boy walked around Masklin.
You must come and see my father, he said.
Of course, it's a foregone conclusion that you'll join the haberdashery.
Your father, he said?
The Duke de Haberdashery, said Angelo proudly. Defender of the mezzanine and autocrat of the staff canteen.
He's three people?
Those are his titles. He's nearly the most powerful gnome in the store.
What does he do?
He's the leader of the haberdashery in the wars against the other departments.
Gnome against gnome?
Of
course. Do these wars happen often? All the time, Angelo told him. How many gnomes live here? Angelo told him.
Two what? Said Masklin.
Angelo repeated it. You don't look very impressed, he said, when Masklin's expression didn't change. Masklin looked hard at the end of his spear. Right now it seemed about the one familiar thing in a bewildering world. I don't know, he said. What is 1,000? Duke Cido de Habitacheri was still in armour and not very amused.
So, you're from outside, are you? Do you really expect me to believe you?
Father, I be quiet.
You know the words of Arnold Brothers, Est 1905? Everything under one roof.
Everything. Therefore, there can be no outside. Therefore, you people are not from it. Therefore, you're from some other part of the store, corsetry or young fashions, maybe. We've never really explored there.
No, where Masklin began, the Duke held up his hands.
Listen to me. I don't blame you. My son is an impressionable young lad. I've no doubt he talked you into it. He's altogether too fond of going to look at lorries, and he listens to silly stories, and his brain gets overheated. Now, I am not an unreasonable gnome, and there is always room for a strong lad like yourself in the Haberdashery Guard, so let's forget this nonsense, shall we?
But we really do come from outside, Masklin persisted.
There is no outside, said the Duke.
Except, of course, when a good gnome dies, if he has led a proper life, then there is an outside where they will live in splendour forever. Come now, he patted Masklin on the shoulder. Give up this foolish chatter and help us in our valiant task.
Yes, but what for? Said Masklin.
You wouldn't want the ironmongery to take our department, would you? Masklin glanced at Angelo, who shook his head urgently.
I suppose not. But you're all gnomes, aren't you? And there's masses for everyone. Spending all your time squabbling seems a bit silly.
Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Angelo put his head in his hands. The Duke went red.
Silly, did you say?
Well,
have you never heard of honour? Said the Duke.
Masklin thought for a while and then shook his head.
The ironmongery want to take over the whole store, said Angelo hurriedly. That would be a terrible thing, and the millinery are nearly as bad.
Why? Said Masklin.
Why? Said the Duke. Because they have always been our enemies. And now,
you may go, he added.
Where?
Said Masklin.
To the ironmongery, or the millinery, or the stationery. They're just the people for you.
I'll go back outside, for all I care, said the Duke sarcastically.
Sorry, said Angelo, when they got away. I should have told you Father had rather a temper.
Masklin had thought the lorry was big. The store was bigger. The underfloor stretched away ahead of them, lit dimly by small lights fixed to the wood here and there. Ironmongery charged highly for the lights, Angelo said, and wouldn't let anyone else into the secret of controlling the electric. It was one of the things that made the ironmongery so powerful.
This is the edge of haberdashery territory at the moment, he said. Over there is millinery country.
We're a bit cool with them at the moment. You're bound to find some department to take you in.
"We're going to stay together," said Granny Morky. She looked hard at Masklin, and then turned back imperiously and waved her hand at Angelo. "Go away, young man! Masklin, stand up straight. Now, forward!" "Who are you saying forward?" said Torrit. "I'm the leader, I am. It's my job giving orders."
"All right," said Granny Morky. "Give 'em, then."
Torrit's mouth worked soundlessly.
Right, he managed. Forward.
Where to? Masklin said, as the old woman shooed them along the dim space.
We will find somewhere.
No harm can befall us if we obey the thing, said Torrit, patting it carefully.
Masklin stopped.
"What does the thing say, then?" he said sharply. "What does it actually tell us to do now?"
Torrit looked a bit desperate.
He began. "It, is clear that if we pulls together and maintains a proper..."
"You're just making it up as you go along. How dare you speak to him like that?" Grimmer began. Masculine flung down his spear. "Well, I'm fed up. The thing says this, the thing says that. The thing says every blessed thing except anything that might be useful. The thing has been handed down from gnome to gnome for hundreds of years," said Grimmer. "It's very important."
"Why?" Grimmer looked at Torrit. He licked his lips.
"It shows us..."
he began, white-faced.
"Move me closer to the electricity."
Torrit, his hand shaking, looked down at the thing. Where there had been smooth black surfaces, there were now little dancing lights, hundreds of them.
"Who said that?" said Masklin.
The thing dropped out of Torrit's grasp and landed on the floor, where its lights glittered like a thousand motorways at night.
"The thing does tell you things," said Masklin. "Gosh."
"Closer to the electricity."
"It wants the electricity," said Masklin.
"Well, I'm not going to touch it," said Torrit.
Masklin shrugged, and then, using his spear gingerly, pushed the thing across the floor until it was under the nearest electric wires.
"How does it speak? It hasn't got a mouth," said Grimmer.
The thing... word. Coloured shapes flickered across its surfaces faster than Masculine's eyes could follow. Most of them were red. Torrit sank to his knees.
"It's angry," he moaned. "We shouldn't have eaten rat. We shouldn't have come here. We shouldn't..."
Masculine also knelt down. He touched the bright areas, gingerly at first, but they weren't hot. "When the thing has told you things before," he said slowly. "You know, how we should live proper lives." Torrit gave him an agonized expression.
"It never has."
"But you said..."
It used to,
moaned Torrit.
"When old Voozle passed it on to me, he said it used to, but he said that hundreds and hundreds of years ago it just stopped."
"What?" said Granny Morky.
"All these years, my good man, you've been telling us that the thing says this and the thing says that and the thing says goodness knows what."
Said Torrit.
"What old Voozle said was, think about what the thing ought to say and then say it. Keep people on the right path, sort of thing."
"What?" shouted Granny.
"That's what he told me to do. It worked, didn't it?"
Masklin ignored them. The coloured lines moved over the thing in hypnotic patterns. He felt that he ought to know what they meant. He was certain they meant something. The thing hummed again.
15,000 years have passed,"
it said.
"Passed what?" Masklin asked.
The thing gave the impression that it was thinking busily. At last it said,
"Do you still know the meaning of the words... flight navigation and recording computer?"
"No," said Masklin earnestly. "None of them." The light pattern moved.
"Do you know anything about interstellar travel?"
"No." The box gave Masklin the distinct impression that it was very disappointed in him.
"Do you know you came here from a place far away?"
it said.
"Oh, yes, we know that."
"A place further than the moon."
Masklin hesitated. The journey in the lorry had taken a long time. It was always possible that they had gone past the moon.
"Yes," he said. "Probably."
"What do you call this planet?"
"I don't know what planet means either," said Masklin.
"An astronomical body."
Masklin looked blank.
"What is your name for this place?"
"It's called The Store."
"The Store."
The lights moved as if the thing was thinking again.
"Do you even remember that you are shipwrecked?"
"I'm Masklin," said Masklin. "I don't know who shipwrecked is."
The lights changed again. Later, when he got to know the thing better, Masklin always thought that particular pattern was its way of sighing deeply.
"My purpose is to serve you and guide you," said the thing.
"See?" said Torrit.
"You've been keeping a bit quiet about it lately, then," Masklin said. The thing hummed.
"This was to maintain internal power. However, I can now use ambient electricity."
"You mean you sort of drink up the light?" said Masklin.
"That will suffice as an explanation for now."
"Why didn't you talk before then?" said Masklin.
"I was listening."
"Oh."
"And now I await instructions."
"In where?" said Grimmer.
"I think it wants us to tell it what to do," said Masklin.
"What can you do?"
"I can translate, calculate, triangulate, assimilate, correlate, and extrapolate."
"I think all we really want is to go home and be safe."
"Go home."
"That's right."
"And be safe."
"Yes." Later on, those five words became one of the most famous quotations in gnome history. They got taught in schools. They got carved in stone. At the time, no one thought they were particularly important. All that happened was that the thing said,
"Computing."
Then all its lights died, except a small green one, which began to flash. They dozed in an alcove formed by two huge wooden walls, and woke up to light as dim as ever. There didn't seem to be any day or night in the store. It did seem noisier, though. There was a distant, all-pervading hubbub. A few more lights were flashing on the thing, and it had grown a little cup-shaped, smaller thing that went round and round very slowly.
"It wasn't as noisy as this when we came here," said Granny. "What a den!"
Masklin looked around. There was a space between the woodwork and a distant gleam of very bright light. He edged towards it and stuck his eye to the crack.
"Oh,"
he said weakly.
"What is it?"
Grimmer called out.
"It's humans. More humans than you've ever seen before."
The crack was where the ceiling joined the wall of a room nearly as big as the lorry nest, and it was indeed full of humans. The store had opened. The space below was crowded with them, walking their great, slow, clumping walk and booming at each other in their deep voices. The gnomes watched, fascinated, for some time. An idea struck Masklin. He lifted up the thing. "Thing?" he said. There was a pause. Then the tinny little voice said,
"Operations on main task suspended. What is it that you require?"
"Do you know what humans are?" said Masklin.
"Humans are the indigenous inhabitants of the world you now call the store. Resuming main task."
"There," said Torrit, nodding wisely. "They're indigenous. Just a lot of indigenouses."
He hesitated.
Indigenous, he corrected himself.
"Are we indigenous?" said Masklin.
"Main task interrupted." "Nope. Main task resumed."
"Course not," said Torrit witheringly. "We've got a bit of pride."
Masklin opened his mouth to ask what indigenous meant. He knew he didn't know, and he was certain that Torrit didn't. Then a voice behind them said,
"Humans are powerful, strange things, aren't they? And very busy just lately. I wonder what's got into them."
It was an elderly, rather stocky gnome, and drably dressed, which was unusual in the store. Most of his clothing was a huge apron, its pockets bulging mysteriously.
"Have you been spying on us?" said Granny Morky.
The stranger gave a shrug.
"I usually come here to watch humans.
What department are you?" "We haven't got one," said Masklin. The stranger grinned and slid off the wooden beam he'd been sitting on.
"Fancy that. You must be these new things I've heard about. Outsiders?"
He held out his hand.
"My name's Dorcas del Icatessen."
He gave Masklin a lopsided grin.
"I reckoned outsiders would have to be a different shape, though. Life, but not as we know it. You just come along with me. I'll show you what I mean."
Where Dorcas led them was just a hole, big, square, deep and dark. A few cables, fatter than a gnome, disappeared down into the depths. Dorcas fumbled in the darkness. There was a click. Far above, something went bang, and there was a distant roaring sound. Something huge and black came down the shaft and stopped a few inches above their heads. There were clangs and thumps and the now familiar sound of humans walking about. There was also, slung under the lift's floor, a small wire basket tied on with bits of string.
"If you think," said Granny Morky, "that I'm going to get into a wire nest on string, then you've got another..."
"Is it safe?" said Masklin.
"More or less, more or less," said Dorcas, stepping across the gap and fumbling with another little bundle of switches. "Hurry up, please. This way, madam. Going up."
There was a clang above them and a slight jerk as they began to rise.
"Good, innit?" said Dorcas. "Took me ages to bypass all the switches. You'd have thought they'd notice, wouldn't you? They press the button to go down, but if I want to go up, we go up.
I used to worry that the humans would think it odd, but they seem powerful dense.
Here we are."
The lift stopped with another jerk, leaving the gnome's basket level with another underfloor gap.
"Electrical and domestic appliances," said Dorcas. "Just a little place I call my own. No one bothers me here, not even the abbot of the stationery. I'm the only one who knows how things work, see?"
It was a place of wires.
They ran under the floor in every direction, great bundles of the things. A few young gnomes were taking something to pieces in the middle of it all.
"Radio," said Dorcas. "Amazing thing.
Trying to figure out how it talks."
He rummaged among piles of thick paper, pulled out a sheet, and passed it to Masklin. It showed a small pinkish cone with a little tuft of hair on top.
"Very nice," said Masklin uncertainly. "What is it?"
"Oh, it was my idea of what an outsider would look like, you see," said Dorcas.
"What, with pointy heads?"
"The rain, you see. In the old legends of the time before the store, rain. Water dropping out of the sky all the time. It'd need to run off. And the sloping sides, as so the wind wouldn't keep knocking it over. I only had the old stories to go on, you see. It hasn't even got any eyes."
"Yes, it has.
Tiny ones, tucked in under the hair so they won't get blinded by the sun. That's a big bright light in the sky," Dorcas added helpfully.
"I think you've got it a bit wrong," said Masklin. "It's not like that at all. Hasn't anyone been to look?"
"I saw the big door open once," said Dorcas. "The one down in the garage, I mean. But there was just a blinding white light outside."
"I expect it would seem like it if you spent all your time in this gloom," said Masklin.
Dorcas pulled up an empty cotton reel.
"You must tell me about it," he said. "Everything you can about the outside."
In Torrit's lap, the thing began to flash another green light.